was on my face, yeah.
Hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is Andrew Vax. Andrew Vax has been a federal investigator in sexually transmitted diseases, a social services caseworker, and a labor organizer, and has directed a maximum security prison for youthful offenders. Now a lawyer in private practice, he represents children and youths exclusively. He is the author of 17 previous novels, including the Burke series, two collections of short stories, and a wide variety of other material, including song lyrics, graphic novels, and a children's book for adults. His books have been translated into 20 languages, and his work has appeared in Parade, Antaeus, Esquire, Playboy, The New York Times, and other magazines and publications. And he's here today to talk about, among other things, his new book, Two Trains Running, just out by Pantheon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Bob.
Great to have you back on. It's been a couple years, and for those who didn't hear that show, would you talk just a little bit to begin with about how you went from being a lawyer to being an author of 18 novels at this point and many other things?
I'm not sure that there was that transition. I had written unsuccessfully for a long time prior to becoming a lawyer. And I'm not one of these people that believes writing is a meritocracy. I'm not one of these people that believes that when you're published, suddenly your writing is better than prior to it being published. So I don't think the transition that you're describing actually took place.
I remember when you were on before, you talked about your first agent had tried and tried and tried to sell your work.
Victor Chapin.
Can you tell that story about that process and then... And then finally selling, and after all that time?
I can. Victor was the kind of agent that writers fantasize about. He read a short story of mine, decided that there was a novel in me, invested years and years and years trying to pry it out of me. When he did, he was rejected by every publishing house in the free world, always on the same grounds. I was such a brilliant, powerful, evocative writer, but the material was fantasy. It was insane. It was way beyond science fiction. As things I was writing about could never happen, there was no point in publishing such a, you know, an addled sort of book. Now, Victor stuck with it. And I kept telling him, my one defense was, they just don't get it, and this is what I do for a living. In fact, what I'm writing about is toned down. Now, I tried and tried and tried, and many times I just said the hell with it, and Victor always persisted, always staying with it, and always encouraging me. Finally, I wrote the book that became Flood, and Victor saw the manuscript. He called me up, really the next day, I guess, and he said he was up all night. It was perfect. I'd finally found that balance between art and truth and blah, 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 blah. We were all going to be rich, and this was going to be a big bestseller, and... You know, then he went and died on me a couple of days later. So he never saw it published. I dedicated it to him, but none of his hard work was ever rewarded in the slightest.
So then what? I mean, you continued practicing law.
Yeah, I mean, there was nothing to interrupt, much less continue. I took the manuscript that Victor thought was going to be such a screaming success and threw it in the drawer. I figured that this was it. This was the end. I certainly didn't want another agent and could never hope to find one like him anyway. And a couple of years later, I was being interviewed by a journalist about one of my cases. And in listening to my narrative, the journalist said, "My goodness, you know, you have such a gift for storytelling, you ought to write a book." And I said, "I did write an expletive deleted book, but it's cursed." And he said, "How is it cursed?" And I briefly told him. He asked to look at it. He showed it to a guy who showed it to a guy. And the infamous Donald I. Fine decided that, you know, I was going to be the next big thing that he was going to risk his money on. He did, and that was that.
Hmm. And so since then, there's been 18 books, a ton of other stuff.
Yep.
And your law practice.
Right.
Now, I know people a lot less busy than you who have a hard time finding the time to write. So where is it?
Well, I think that's because I don't know these people, so I don't know if they think of themselves as artistes or the way I think of myself, which is as a laborer. And I never believed that God decreed man shall work 40 hours a week. To me, it's always been a second job, an organic extension of my primary job, and finding the time to do it's never been an issue.
Hmm. Well, I recall you saying something when you were on last about how I'm not going to phrase this as you did, but something to the effect of that your books find a larger.
What I said was the books get me a much bigger jury than
yes.
I'd ever get in a courthouse, sure.
Yeah.
And it's true. I would never have had the opportunity to speak before audiences in, you know, Australia or in Italy or in Germany or any of the other places I've been without the books. It's the books that got me there.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Andrew Vax. His current book is called Two Trains Running, published by Pantheon. This book is quite a departure. You wrote, among other things, again, I always say that because you've done so many, such a variety of things, but a series with a character named Burke. And this, in contemporary times, and this book takes place in the fall of 1959. It's just before the 1960 election of John F. Kennedy. You've taken historical facts and you have created a work of fiction. Will you talk about what got you to this? What inspired this book and dealing with this time that you are in it?
I believe 1959, that period that I wrote about, that because the whole book, you know, it's 500 pages, takes place within 2 weeks. I believe that was the fulcrum on which all American sociopolitics have turned. If you simply take that year and go back 5 years and go ahead 5 years, you've got an encapsulation of every single thing that's occurred in American politics since and is occurring, in fact, right now. For example, if you look at the recent conviction of that human being in Mississippi for complicitousness in killing Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, or you look at the recent exhumation of the body of Emmett Till, if you look at numerous other prosecutions for civil rights era murders, you'll see they all had one thing in common. It's not new evidence. Somebody opened up FBI files. That was a drive theme in 1959. That's no less a drive theme in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't, the Burke books just wouldn't work to do this because I needed a third-person narration. And I needed to try, well, at least I needed for myself to try a different technique entirely. So the entire book, although it's third person, there's no omniscient narrator. You don't read the thoughts of anybody. You don't get anybody's backstory. It's a series of surveillance opportunities. You listen and you watch, and from there you need to draw all the conclusions on which to base your final judgments.
Mm-hmm.
The judgments aren't made for you.
Yes. Well, you mentioned you sort of mentioned the structure, and I wanted to ask you about organizing the book the way that you did with each section is marked by a date and time. And as you said, it takes place over 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. I mean, did you come up with the structure first, or did you come up with the story first, and then the structure sort of weaseled its way in and said, this is the way you need to present the story? How did that happen?
It took me a very, very long time to write this book, many, many, many years. And the last thing I got was the structure. I struggled for a very long time with how to present the material. Once I got it organized, once I got it narrated, I still had a problem with how to present it. And this structure was my answer to how I could put the reader in the book, because that was my goal.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And it's my hope that of those who read it, opinions are going to vary. I don't mean opinions about the quality of the book or the wonderfulness of the writing. I mean opinions about the actual events that they've been made part of.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think I must have seen it on the website for the book on twotrainsrunning.com. You said, for me, the success of this book will be measured not only by how many questions it raises, but by how many questioners it creates.
That's it. I mean, this book is my ode to journalism. This book is my statement that investigative journalism is all that stands between us and the loss of democracy. And this book is my attempt to show the critical importance of not just accepting what you're told.
Hmm. Well, you know, along those lines, you also write journalism and have throughout.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that for you? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, when you're writing fiction, you can do pretty much whatever you want. You can take a piece of journalism, you can take research, and then do pretty much what you want with it. When you are writing a journalistic piece, you very much have to stick with what you find.
Well, at least you're supposed to.
You are supposed to.
I don't think that's the American experience, but yeah, that's what you're supposed to do, sure.
So then for you, where's the overlap, I guess, is what I'm asking. You know, I mean, you deal in your fiction with so much that is going on in the news, in life, in the world, and you make fiction out of it. You create characters, you create situations, and it's fiction. When you're writing articles, they're articles. They're you know, totally different voice. Talk about that. I guess that the bridge between the two, and when something you find becomes fiction, and you know that this is a novel, this isn't something I'm going to spend time on for an article.
I've actually never had that experience, because if you read the articles and you read the quote fiction unquote, you're hard pressed to see a radical difference.
Except for maybe your characters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Except for the form in which they're presented. You need a different kind of narrative force entirely for fiction, if only to sustain its length. Although with short stories, you know, it's like fighting in a phone booth. Miss one punch and you're done. So the truth is, I don't see this big gap at all. When I wrote about predatory pedophiles, modem trafficking, and kiddie porn, book reviewers went insane screaming out what a sick mind I had and what a fevered imagination. That's because it was in 1986. Well, that wasn't fiction. Certainly, the character that I had doing it was fictional, but the foundational basis was not fiction. I don't believe that, you know, book reviewers get to judge the truth of what they're reviewing. All they do is get to judge whether they like it or not. And that's a very, very different standard.
Hmm. How do reviews affect you? Do you read them?
When I first got published, I read them all because I thought, like a moron, that I was actually going to learn something. I thought that, you know, there was a critical community, and just like, you know, when you're learning to box, people watch and they give you tips and learn to be a better boxer. However, if the tips conflict to the point of being diametrically opposed, you just get a headache trying to listen.
Mm-hmm.
So I get a little sick of reading that I'm the next Dickens and the king of vigilante slasher porn for the same book. I just get tired of it. What I've learned about book reviewing is this. It's essentially nonsense. It has no objective criteria to it. There's no standards or values. What happens is a person decides, and I'm even assuming an honest person, not a person with an agenda to advance, but just, you know, a person likes a book or doesn't like a book, and they then craft language to justify how they feel. You could take any book in the entire world that was ever written, and if you wanted to make the book sound silly, you could find a sentence in the book that you could surround with your own verbiage and make it seem like the writer was an idiot. You see that happening all the time, and you could do it reverse, too. You could find one gem of a sentence probably in, you know, a hunk of junk. So I've never been impressed with book reviewing as a way to learn anything about the craft. And this goes, you know, and I have to be prepared if I'm going to say that I reject this criticism as being stupid and uninformed or even with an agenda, I've also got to reject the praise. And I, in fact, do that now. So it's truth to say that I don't actually read the book reviews anymore.
And there is quite a lot of praise for your work. Sure. Now, I wasn't familiar with your first novels when they came out, so...
Oh, some people loved them. That was the whole point. Some people loved them. Some people hated them. But it had nothing to do with the writing. It had nothing to do with the book.
Sure.
And to this day, I'm so stereotyped that I don't actually expect a fair shake at all. There was a recent review of the new book that was almost mind-boggling, you know, as a critical document. It said, boy, I'm really glad Andrew Vax wrote this book. This Two Trains Running is terrific. It's wonderful. It's not like his other books, which are all these graphic depictions of child sexual abuse. Now, I haven't read those books, but I'm told that's what they are, and so I never went and read them because I don't like that sort of stuff. But since this one wasn't about that, I was able to read it. The only problem is the books that he's talking about don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So now this is a review that loved Two Trains Running. Am I supposed to get excited about it?
Right. And yet there is so much emphasis on reviews. I mean, agents, editors, everybody wants the review in the New York Times. They want the review in Publishers Weekly. And, I mean, there's a little less emphasis on it than there used to be because there's so many other options for bringing attention to your work. But there's...
And there's also 5,000 bloggers who are, you know, creating reviews.
Right.
Of course, you know, one doesn't want to look too closely as to how many of them are writers and how many of them are negotiating and trying to get their stuff published. And,
sure. You know,
one doesn't want to look too closely at that. But I don't actually agree with you. I don't understand this emphasis on reviews. For what? I mean, you think that publishers really care? They, at least when it comes to my books, they think they're funny. I mean, this last book had the standard response. Kirkus loved it and gave it a star. PW thought it was horrible and disgusting and recommend that nobody read it. So?
Hmm. Well, at least that's what agents say that come on the show. You know, they want the reviews for their
books. Well, of course you'd rather have them than not have them, Barbara.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, given a choice between bad reviews and good reviews, who wouldn't want good reviews?
Hmm.
And there are a lot of sheep in America. There are people who won't make any effort on their own, will sort of prattle, well, I always check to see what the New York Times says, and then they just, you know, follow the yellow brick road.
Sure.
Well, for those people, of course, you'd want a good review in the New York Times. But I don't think any agent, I don't know, I can't speak for agents, but I can't imagine anyone saying the reviews have inherent value.
Mm-hmm.
What they have is, for those people who rely on them, and it doesn't have to be a book review, it could be a restaurant review or a movie review or, you know, but what people need to understand, whether they like it or not, is book reviews are not consumer reports.
Right.
They're not taking products and testing them to an objective standard and saying which one is better. They're telling you what they like. And the inherent conceit of any book reviewer is that what he or she likes will be important to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting. There's so many books that you don't see reviewed in major places that become that just sell off the rack, and you know, because there's such word of mouth going for it.
Any agent that doesn't admit that word of mouth is 1,000 times more important than book reviews is too dumb to be at large.
Right.
The trick is how to get the word of mouth. That's what they really want.
Mm-hmm.
When they talk about reviews, they really are talking about one little tile in a huge mosaic. That's one possible way to start word of mouth. But believe me, if you could get word of mouth as opposed to any reviews, you would take the word of mouth.
Yeah. Yes. I always think of Bridges of Madison County as one of those books that was panned, and serious writers couldn't stand it. But quite a few readers loved it, and boy, you know.
Well, I don't even understand what a serious writer is. What does it mean? Is somebody who the New York Times says is a good writer?
I guess I'm talking about people who take themselves seriously as writers.
Well, hell, you could take yourself seriously as all hell and be a pathetic excuse for anything, including a writer.
Yeah.
Self-absorption's not unknown among the writing fraternity.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here with Andrew Vax, author of Two Trains Running. I have to say that one thing I like about you is you are just so blunt. And
this isn't blunt. This is euphemism because
well, no, you're
of
just
your show.
Very no, but it's just you're very honest, and you just seem like, you know, what you see is what you get. Your opinions. You air your opinions, and you don't seem to worry about impressing or unimpressing or whatever.
I worry very much about being respected. I worry not a moment about being liked.
Hmm.
And I believe I can behave in such a way that I'll be worthy of people's respect, and that the respect that I have is the respect that I've earned. As far as being liked, the price of that, way too high.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting one.
Well, in the writing business? Come on.
Yeah.
You'll never see such a collection of favored traders
mm-hmm.
as you will among writers.
Mm.
I'll blurb this, you blurb that.
Right.
You know, people don't, when you talk about journalism, you're not calling book reviews journalism, are you? Because they don't meet the disclosure requirements.
Right.
People don't say, well, I'm reviewing this book and this is my girlfriend
mm-hmm.
or my cousin or somebody who's also represented by my same agent or, you know, come on.
And yet I think probably the reading public would like to think that there's objectivity there.
I don't believe the reading public who actually rely on reviews could give a damn.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they're essentially sheep. Because you're investing somebody else with the power to make your decisions for you. There's something called a public library. You know, anybody can get off their butt and go down there and sample the merchandise.
Right.
Instead, you want to sit and read a newspaper? You want to be that dumb? How many books are published every month, Barbara?
Well, if there's something like 70,000 a year going into the bookstores, man.
Come on. 70,000 a year into the bookstores is a really low number. It's probably double that in terms of books published.
Oh, definitely.
Well, how many are reviewed?
Yeah.
So that's like if I asked you to pick a girlfriend for me, right? But said you can only pick girls from this 3-block radius instead of the entire country. How smart would I be?
Mm.
Well, that's what people do with book reviewing. They say, you know what? I'm going to trust this book reviewer not only to make up my mind for me, but to make up my mind for me about what I should make my mind up about. Yeah, it's not just what I'll eat on the menu, but what gets on the menu.
Sure.
And that's what they're doing.
Hmm.
That's why I'm a giant fan of excerpts. If I had my way, every book published would be on this giant website that would be indexed by genre and all this other stuff. And would contain, everybody'd be given, oh, I don't know, 2,500 words. You pick out of your book whatever 2,500 words you like, throw it up on their website. And, you know, let the best writer win. Let the public actually decide.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and new writers are especially hampered by the worry of the reviews and the marketplace and, you know, so sort of difficult keeping the market out of your office or out of your room or away from you when you're writing.
I'm not disagreeing, but it doesn't mean you have to get down on your knees
to
it.
Sure,
sure. I mean, sure, listen, nobody knows this better than me because I've never in my life signed a multiple book contract and won't. So if this book tanks, I can have no assurance at all that my publisher will say, gee, we'd like to see another one.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that I live or die book to book, but it hasn't made me run around joining organizations every damn day.
Right. And on that, we're going to take a break, and we will be right back with Andrew Vax, author of Two Trains Running. So don't go away. Stay right there.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we are on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I've been here with Andrew Vax, author of Two Trains Running, since 5 o'clock. And before I go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests, and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. Hello again.
Hi, Barbara.
I want to say also, before we go on, that this Saturday you will be at Skylight Books in Los Angeles at 5 p.m.
Yeah, bizarre, isn't it? 5 p.m.?
5 p.m.
Yeah, my entire career I've never done an event at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, but this will be fun.
Well, you know, maybe. Well, it's Saturday. I was going to say traffic. You know, it's good on a weekend, 5 o'clock in L.A. Everybody's at dinner, and the freeways are open, and people can get to you.
Okay.
Skylight Books' website is skylightbooks.com. You can find more details on it. You can find their address, phone number, everything. Will you be talking? Will you be signing? What will you be doing?
Well, I always end up signing books. That's kind of part of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
But I much prefer to have a dialogue than a rant. And if I can get the audience to engage with me, and so far I always have, it'll be a conversation.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I want to pick up on what you were talking about before the break, which is that you have not signed a multiple book contract.
Mm-hmm.
I recall you saying this last time, and what I remember is that it frees you up a bit from having to, and I think you also said that you write the book. You write it first and submit it.
Right. I don't have an agent. I write the book. When the book is completely done and I have a book, I then show it to the publisher and ask them if they want it.
And, of course, they always do.
I don't know about of course. Up to now, they have. But I don't know if that decision is based on literary merit or commercial performance of the prior book.
And yet, probably 99% of authors will take that contract and take that advance and hope to fulfill it.
Well, God bless them. I mean, I'm not telling them how to behave. For me, that would be putting myself in shackles, and I don't want to do that. Keeping my word sacred to me, if I say I'm going to meet a deadline, I'm going to meet a deadline. I don't know if you read the op-ed piece I had in the New York Times last week on the Michael Jackson verdict.
No, I still have the that section that I haven't gone through yet, but I will.
Okay. There's a lot of reasons why I could have been picked for it, but one of the reasons I know I was picked for it was I could deliver it within the extremely tight deadline that was necessary between the verdict and publication. I keep my word. If I say I'm going to do something, I do it. I don't want to commit myself to writing a whole novel by a particular date because I have another life and things intervene. So it's much better for all concerned if I simply write the books first.
Yeah. Well, I'm dying to know what you said in that op-ed piece now.
Okay, well, it's on. I'm sure it's still on the Times website.
No, I have the section at home. I have a pile I'm still going through. So, yeah, I'm going to have to run home and read that. Because I actually, when I knew you were coming on the show and the verdict came down, I was thinking, I wonder what he thinks about all this. Oh, my gosh.
Well, I got my chance, yeah.
Going back to what you said some time back, you said two trains running took many years. You've had other novels, Burke novels, come out since. I would imagine since you started Two Trains Running.
Oh, quite a number of them, actually. I've probably been working on the book, I mean, no less than 7-8 years, maybe more.
So how does that all work for you, working on sort of projects concurrently? Are you scheduled, or when something hits you, do you work on it? How does that work for you?
I don't have that luxury. I'm driven by my career representing children and doing all the work that's associated with that. When I get information that I want to act on at some point, I file it and I wait for the opportunity to open up those files. It's not unusual, for example, to be working on half a dozen cases at once, so there's nothing so unusual about working on half a dozen writing projects at once.
What about getting back into the voice? Because Two Trains Running has a different voice than the Burke. As you said, Burke is a close point of view. This is third person.
It's more detached than third person. Most third person narrations, even leading aside their leaden exposition, are omniscient. You know, you're inside everybody's mind. You know what everybody's thinking. You know how everybody got there. And in fact, they make all the judgments for you. They tell you so-and-so was a good person or so-and-so was a bad person. Or so-and-so had a little bit of good and a little bit of bad in them. You know? In this case, there's nothing like that. This is simply a series of surveillance opportunities for the reader. So it's a different kind of third-person narration.
So finding the voice again, as opposed to, say, you're working on a Burke novel?
It's no more difficult than switching from a pretrial memoranda to an appeal. It's no more different from switching from writing a parade article to an op-ed piece for the Times.
Interesting.
The voice, you know... Supposedly, the voice is always different because people love to talk about that as part of the craft, but it's always my voice one way or the other.
Do you feel that you write as you talk? Is that part of the voice?
I've certainly been accused of that.
But, you know, is that maybe that's the thing, you know, because I find with writers, you're one of them, that very much sound in their writing as they do when they're talking, that... And which is one reason why you like certain writers, too, because you want to hear that. You know, you don't want a manufactured voice.
Oh, come on. How many hard-boiled writers would, you know, tremble at the thought of going out at night by themselves? People don't actually want the voice, most of the time, of the person who's writing. They want a voice that they like.
But that's what I mean. We read those voices that we like. You know, we're not going to keep reading a novel where we go, you know, I don't like this. I don't like the sound. I don't like the feel.
Well, I think it's right. But it's really not based on, again, objective criteria. It's based on what people like.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not based on, for example, an evaluation of realism in novels.
Sure.
Because then you could make a judgment. But you're completely correct. People, whether it's a television program, a book, a piece of music, all the fancy critics aside, people go with what they like.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Two Trains Running, I wanted to talk about one of the characters anyway, with the interesting name Walter Dett. And Walker Dett. And it's such a, it has a lot of meaning. It has some symbolic value. And I wonder about you coming up with that name and what you were after and when you knew you had it, you know?
Well, when you read to the end of the book, the name will make perfect sense to you. I mean, that's all I can say.
But, I mean, in terms of coming up with it, did you have it at the start?
Because I knew. I'm not one of these people that has this, magical, lyrical, creative process where I just start writing and the book tells itself. I mean, I sit down. I know where I'm going to start, where I'm going to finish, how I'm going to get there. And then I have to find the right vehicles to do it. For me, this guy only had one possible name.
Hmm. You once described your writing as the process for you is transcribing.
Mm-hmm. Because I do the writing in my head. So that by the time I sit down, if you saw me writing, you'd say, damn it, guy can type fast.
Interesting. Yeah, I find that interesting. I mean, especially it seems that with crime novels or investigative novels or mysteries, there's a lot more plot that's important than, say, a literary novel or something that isn't where suspense isn't as important, you know, where twists and turns are not as important. Plot points are not as important.
Oh, maybe so. I don't know. I have no experience. I've tried to read novels that have been praised for the beauty of their language, and I get bored and don't finish them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's impossible to combine all the elements you described and beautiful, well-crafted language. I'm just saying that beautiful, well-crafted language that doesn't say anything has
sure.
no particular impact on me.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Andrew Vax, author of Two Trains Running. Is there anything in your past, in your upbringing, that pointed to you being a writer?
Hell no.
Well, what were you into as a kid? Were you a reader?
What's a kid?
You know,
a kid could be 16 years old, a
sure,
kid could be 6 years old. What's
16
a kid?
And younger. You know, a little kid growing up, becoming a teenager, you know, at
but
home.
Those are different worlds entirely. I mean, I don't know about you, but puberty had a significant impact on the things I was interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that was a big change then. Certainly nothing I was interested in as a teenager resembled the literary pursuit.
Hmm. Where did you think you were headed? Did you have any
into
idea?
Into the service, into the
uh-huh.
military.
Uh-huh.
That or the aircraft plant. Those seemed to be the two options at the time.
Huh. And, you know, in your bio, which touches on that you were a federal investigator, in sexually transmitted diseases and a social services caseworker, I'm imagining that those jobs had a great deal to do with the types of novels that you started to write.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
That and, you know, being on the ground in that genocidal horror known as Biafra,
mm-hmm.
and running the maximum security prison. And what I've done with my life doesn't just, you know, inform my work. It drives everything that I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one writer, whatever you think of me as a writer, I'm not someone that has to hire a researcher.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. It's interesting stuff. I mean, I don't know that anyone is quite doing what you're doing, you know?
Oh, I think they're probably well advised.
I mean, God, what other, you know, lawyers that take on child abuse cases that have been in Biafra do we know that write investigative novels? I don't think there's any.
I don't know. Although I've been called the only one of its kind a lot, it's not always meant as a compliment. So.
Well, I think it's a good thing.
Well, so do I. I mean, this is a voluntary choice on my part.
Sure. Is one fiction or journalism more satisfying than the other, or do they just
is journalism, you see. I mean, I'm trying to accomplish the same thing. I'm trying to make people aware and make them angry and make them interested in finding out more and make them see the relevance, in fact, the direct impact on their own self-interest of events that are going on in the world in their own lives. So I'm not sure that there's a radical difference. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I'd have the capacity to write a story that was, you know, just fun.
Sure.
And I'm in no way putting down such stories. You know, I think they're great, and I can't believe that anyone's, you know, grown to adulthood without being entertained by some writers and just enjoyed that for the experience. It's just not something I think I could do.
Hmm. Well, yeah. Well, but I would imagine when you're writing, it is fun.
Well, then you would imagine wrong if you're talking about me. I don't have any fun at all. In fact, it's painful to do it.
Huh.
I'm not writing about stuff that makes me happy.
Sure.
And I experience it very intensely as I write it. In fact, my goal would be if I could communicate to you how I feel about what I'm telling you about, I would be the writer I dream of being.
Hmm.
But it's not fun.
Well, then maybe fun is the wrong word here, because it just, you know, your writing is so intense. And I just, you know, I guess my idea is that it has to be gratifying what
that's
culminates.
That's different. Look, hard work isn't fun, but the results are gratifying.
Hmm.
So I don't want to confuse the process with the end product.
Sure.
So writing in and of itself is not fun for me and not gratifying, but the net effect of the writing has been not only gratifying, it's been beyond my wildest fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we have a few minutes left with Andrew Vax, author of Two Trains Running, published by Pantheon.
My new publisher.
Your new publisher?
My new publisher.
Hmm. How are they?
They're wonderful. I mean, right now, I mean, it's our honeymoon, so, I mean, you know.
Well, how's the marketing end of things for you? Once the book is done doing your tours and going into bookstores, do you enjoy all of that?
You know what? I very much enjoy the dialogue. I mean, that's terrific. I not only enjoy it, but I learn a lot. And those opportunities, I think, are just great. And I enjoy the opportunity to tell people who write not to be ashamed of themselves and not to let some twit define them by saying, oh, are you published, as if, you know, oh, are you a real person? I really like that. I don't like, you know, the eBay merchants who show up and, you know, with, you know, 125 books in cartons and, you know, say that they're collectors. You know, obviously there's parts of that, you know, like nobody in their right mind would like to travel. But bottom line, it's a great opportunity and I'm grateful to have it.
Hmm. People really bring you multiple books to sell or to sign?
They bring them. They're not successful. But, oh, I've had people bring books in on a hand truck.
That's amazing to me that people have nerve to...
They have nerve to do anything because they're going into a bookstore in which they haven't even bought a damn book. And the bookstore's taking the time and trouble to advertise the event. They've set aside space. They've got personnel. They've ordered books. And now this clown comes in who's a pure eBay merchant with his own product that he's accumulated from God knows where, and expects to quadruple the value of it by getting a signature.
Hmm.
And plus, of course, wants to hold up the line for everybody and do it.
I don't know. Sometimes. Okay. you have said, and we've talked about how you have the book sort of worked out in your head before you write it,
mm-hmm.
and then you sit down and it comes out. With two trains running, by the time you reached the end of this book, over the years that it took, were there any discoveries or tangents or things you found out that were surprising to you?
No, just I wrestled with it for so long, I was out of surprises. It was like I took such a long time to assemble the parts and polish the parts. Finding a way to make them all fit together is really what took the most time. And in doing so, it was more a technical problem than it was any sort of creative problem.
Technical in that?
I had to find a way to do it. Mm-hmm. I've got a ton of material. It's like a 150,000-word book that takes place in 2 weeks. And I've got to keep the surveillance going so that it never stops. So as you leave one opportunity and you go into another, the opportunity you left is still continuing, running in the background, so that when you pick it up again, you actually have a sense that you're picking it up with its momentum, not as static. Those were technical problems that had to be solved. But I didn't change anything substantively as I was solving the problem.
Mm-hmm. I have to mention this cover because I don't know, it's something that attracts me to books. And this cover is so, well, it's a black and white photograph, in case you haven't seen it, you out there. And there's a train, there's a car. Must be a photo from what? From the 50s.
Oh, yeah.
And did you have any say in this cover?
I have cover approval. It's part of my contract.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't discover the cover. I mean, the art department discovered a number of covers and presented them and said, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And this is the one I loved. And I very much wanted a black and white book because this entire book is shades of gray.
Yes. Yeah. Tell me what you loved about the cover and what was happening for
you. The cover fit perfectly. I was listening to your break music, and clearly you're not unfamiliar with blues. So Two Trains Running is that's a classic, and you're saying there's a train in a car, but it's not quite that simple. There's a train rushing by at very high speed over a bridge abutment. Under the bridge in a washed-out dirt area is a car that's not moving. Two trains are always running, the one you see and the one you don't see. This book is two books. It's a really, really fast-moving river. If you just want to read this as a hard-boiled crime novel, it'll just rock it on right through for you.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an undercurrent. And if you take the time, make the effort to look at the undercurrent, then the whole thing changes. So there's always two trains running, and hence the title.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's a wonderful title, too. Was it your title from the start?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's, in fact, when you get to the resolution of the book, you'll see that it would have to be that title.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love when titles are revealed to you as you read, and that you, and even perhaps not until the end, do you know why it was titled that. I think it's one of those things that leads you into the book, and then it's so satisfying to find out why.
I hope it is, because if the reader doesn't accept a character's motivation at the end, then the book fails. So it's a high risk kind of undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the rewards will be proportionate.
Do you test your work out on anyone?
Oh, well, that's not fair. I do have a circle of Confederates who always go over my stuff, but they're not literary people. I'm not saying they have no literary ability, they certainly do. But they're more specialists than they are, literature type people.
Yes.
It's my goal always to turn in ultra clean manuscript.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, again, you're going to be at Skylight Books this Saturday at 5 p.m. And the website is skylightbooks.com. You have a website for this book, too.
Yep. Same as the title, twotrainsrunning.com.
Yeah. Interesting website.
Yeah, we've never done a dedicated website for a book before, but it's something the publisher came up with as an idea. And if anyone's been to my website, we've got people there with web skills that are ridiculous, and it was nothing for them to put this together. Sure. Even though it's got, you know, it's got audio clips, it's got all kinds of fancy stuff, but you know, Kim was able to put this thing together, and I just an eye blink, it seemed, and to keep it fresh because it gets updated, you know, with new stuff all the time.
Oh, we're at the end of our time, and I always ask this question. Well, not always, but most of the time. Any advice you have for the writers listening?
Yeah, I mean, I thought I'd been doing that all along.
Well, you know, more advice,
and we haven't talked about. here's my advice to writers. Spectators don't win fights. You know, don't be running around asking everybody else's opinion, because as soon as those opinions conflict, you're going to get confused. You know, it's work, and you get better at work by doing the work. As long as you're going to be hooked into this nonsense that there's an actual meritocracy out there, that there's actual judgments that count, you're going to be, at least in my opinion, stifled terribly. You have to just throw the punch. I have no advice about how to get published. I have no advice about how to find an agent. I don't know anything about either topic. But I know a lot about not quitting. And that's the essential advice.
Well, that's great advice. And I thank you once again for taking the time. I know you're tired and busy and running around, so thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Barbara.
You're quite welcome. That was Andrew Vax, author of Two Trains Running, talking to us from Seattle, and he'll be down in L.A. on Saturday, 5 o'clock, Skylight Books. And if my time frees me up, I want to make it up there, so I hope some of you do too. And if you want to know more about the show, you can go to penonfire.com. That's my website. And click on the radio tower, and you will go to my radio page. There's info about my book on there. And you can also email me if you want to be on my weekly email list, penonfire.com. I always leave you with quotes. Today's no different. This one is by Edna O'Brien in The Writer's Chapbook, edited by George Plimpton some time ago. Writers are always anxious, always on the run, from the telephone, from people, from responsibilities, from the distractions of the world. I would add from email as well. And I thank you again for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next time.